Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The state's primary elections are just a few weeks away, and so today on the Roundup, we continue our Meet the Candidate series with Republican Matt Mowers. He's hoping to be his party's nominee for the 1st Congressional District. We'll be speaking to his opponent, Matt Mayberry, in 2 weeks, on August 28th. We'll also cover some of the week's top New Hampshire headlines, including a new mask mandate for gatherings of more than 100 people, and Granite State reaction to Joe Biden's choice of Kamala Harris for a running mate. As always, we welcome your comments, so send them in by email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, or you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. So let's begin our Meet the Candidate series. And Matt Mowers, welcome to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura. Really appreciate it.
Well, so focusing on the primary first, why should Republican voters choose you over Matt Mayberry? Why are you the better Republican choice?
Look, Laura, I think there's a few things. And I've known Mayberry for almost a decade now. And, you know, we've been friends for almost a decade and will remain so after the primary. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, I've been able to bring a different set of life experiences, whether it was my time serving in the State Department, both as senior White House advisor, but also then as chief of staff in our global health office, where we took on a global HIV epidemic and have been able to take some of the really well-learned lessons from that and apply them to how we respond to COVID-19, whether it's also just where we are on the issues. You know, I'm the only one who has never run for and never held political office before. You know, and so I bring a new perspective and a new set of energy to this race. It's the same type of perspective and energy I'll bring down to Congress. It's one of the reasons why I'm a firm believer in term limits. I just think that we need to fundamentally change the system down in Washington, D.C. I'm also a big believer that we need to be spending less money than we are right now, and that we need to make sure that people can keep more of their hard-earned money. So I'm the only candidate running who has signed a pledge saying I will not raise taxes on people of New Hampshire or America, as well as the fact I'm the only one running who has not actually raised taxes on anyone before. So, you know, there are some differences, but ultimately the real reason I'm running is because I believe Chris Pappas has let our district down. I believe that 2 years ago, he was running around all this district saying he was going to work with both sides of the aisle. He was going to even work with the president where it made sense. He was going to be willing to stand up to his party leadership when he thought it was the right thing to do. And unfortunately, he's done none of that. He has gone along with the entire crowd down in Washington, D.C., and that crowd is usually the far left wing of his party. And I just think we can have better representation in New Hampshire to represent us down in Washington, D.C., and that's why I pledge to deliver.
Well, I'll definitely ask you about Congressman Pappas in a few moments. But in terms of, you know, again, the primary, so are you saying that you have more broad experience than Matt Mayberry, given your experience in Washington? Because Mr. Mayberry is saying, look, this guy's from the outside. He doesn't know New Hampshire. He's been dipping in and out of the state for a long time. I'm rooted here. I know the state. Vote for me.
Yeah, well, look, you know, I actually spent a lot of time in New Hampshire when I was a kid in Stratford County. My dad actually was a diver on the Seabrook power plant, so New Hampshire's always been a special part of my life. You know, had to move around a lot like a lot of middle-class families do. You know, my dad would be helping run projects, whether it was to, you know, build pipelines or, you know, pipelines and a whole bunch of other, you know, marine construction projects. And he was actually a deepwater sea diver for a long time. But we had to move around like a lot of middle-class families do. I came back right after college, though. I served as executive director of the Republican Party, you know, when I was in my early 20s and met my wife here, you know, got engaged here. It's where we call home. So it's always been a special part of our life. And so, you know, look, I get it. We're less than 4 weeks out from a primary. Candidates are going to say things that just aren't true about others. But the fact of the matter is that New Hampshire's been where I call home, and it's a special part of our life, and I look forward to representing New Hampshire's values down in Washington, D.C.
You know, I'm interested in your experience at the Global Health Office. Was that part of your time at the State Department, Matt?
It was, yeah. So I was chief of staff, actually, to Dr. Deborah Birx, who we all kind of know very well in her work in the Coronavirus Task Force. And
sure.
We ran a program called PEPFAR. It's the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. I started in 2003 as a response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, at the time, in 2003, you had these life-saving drugs available to much of the what we call the developed world and the Western world, especially here in the United States. But you had over 30 million people on the continent of Africa who are HIV positive, and less than 50,000 of them were on this life-saving treatment. And this treatment is so good now, it takes one pill a day, and you can take what used to be a death sentence, has now become essentially a chronic disease. And not only that, but if you're on treatment, you stay on treatment, you don't pass the virus on to others. So you actually can cut down on transmission rates almost 100%. And so started up this program, and it really showed a lot of commitment and generosity from the American people. Plus, it was in our national security interests. You know, this was right after 9/11, and there was a real fear that if you had 30 million people with a deadly disease on one continent, that you would have had child head of households, that then children would be susceptible to recruitment movements from extremist groups.
Right.
Actually, 25% of some of our allied forces, Uganda, for example, were HIV positive. If one in four of our allied forces became too ill to participate in counter-terror exercises or actually died, that'd be a huge impact on our national security. And so, you know, I started up this program, and 17 years later, it's now saved over 15 million lives.
I'm really interested in this, given you worked at the Global Health Office. Here we are in a global pandemic. What's your perspective around how the Trump administration has led the country through this coronavirus pandemic? Because I'm sure you look at the numbers like I do. The U.S. looks pretty bad.
Well, look, let's go back to January when we were all first finding out where this was. You know, I was the first candidate in the country to actually call for travel restrictions from mainland China. And I did that having the knowledge of how viruses and disease and epidemics spread and, you know, increase and decrease and the rest of it. The president then instituted that travel restriction 2 days later, and it was the right call to make because it gave us time to prepare in a way that we otherwise wouldn't. You then flash forward, and you know, one of the things that we did in our fight against global HIV/AIDS was you bring in the private sector as a partner because you have to. I mean, they're the ones who are producing the drugs. I mean, for example, HIV/AIDS right now, because of the work we did with the private sector, is now $75 per patient per year for a life-saving drug. $75. That wouldn't be possible without working with the private sector. And you saw that same approach brought here, whether it was bringing in CEOs of diagnostic companies like Abbott and Roche, whether it was bringing in drug companies, drug store companies like Walgreens and CVS and even Walmart and others in order to help improve drive-through testing, to expand our testing capabilities. And I will say, they've been able to now in a very short period of time be able to move towards finding new testing and diagnostics. That's why you have a lot of different testing capabilities right now.
I think the testing's been kind of lacking, actually. In my own experience, it's been scattershot and all over the map, frankly.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, we do have a federalized system of government here in the United States, right? So it is up to each state to implement these plans and design them in a custom way. We have found that the governor has done a very good job at ensuring that we have ramped up testing capabilities. And that's a piece of it. You have not always had that in every other state, though. So, I mean, I know there's a lot of comparisons, and one place that people like to compare to is South Korea. South Korea is a very different different place. I mean, it's got an integrated healthcare system. It's a population where majority of them live around one city, which is our capital city of Seoul. So it's just very different from the United States. And so, you know, here in the U.S., we do have a federal, you know, we do believe in federalism, and the states get to drive the decisions on these. And so the real important thing is making sure that the states have the tools and decision-making capabilities available to make decisions and set up a system that's in the best interest of its people. Fortunately, governor's done a very good job of that here in New Hampshire, and you've seen that we have low COVID rates in large part because of that.
So do you think, and again, it's interesting given your experience in global health, do you think that the U.S.'s numbers look so bad not through the fault of the Trump administration, but more because we have 50 public health services instead of one federal public health service. Is that what you're saying? Because again, comparing us to the rest of the world, we don't look good.
I'm not saying that, only because I don't believe that federalizing the system would actually improve outcomes. It wouldn't. We just have too different of a population. We're more sparsely populated in a number of states. Given the healthcare service delivery models that are used, a federalized system would not work. What does need to be done, though, I will say, is that we need to continue working with the private sector. So, for example, I've called for this, and it's a part of my plan, is for us to, especially for areas that are vital for supply chain, for national security, for agriculture, that we need to be working with the private sector to figure out how we can get them rapid testing available so that companies can continue to operate, employees can feel safe into that job each day. And we also know that we're doing what's necessary to prevent the spread of COVID-19. We can do that. I mean, take, for example, there's a big concern about Smithfield pork production several months ago. We should be working with companies like that, so in a public-private partnership, to find a way to make available more rapid testing so that they can get employees back to work. And then we can also ensure the supply chain is not interrupted for the American people. And Laura, not to digress a little bit, but on that point, it's why one of the biggest things I'm a supporter of, too, is moving manufacturing back from China in some of these key areas, including pharmaceutical production, including PPE production, and then even agriculture and the national security core components. I think we have the political will to do it right now. And if we actually are willing to have leaders who are willing to step up and say, yes, we need to incentivize these companies to bring that manufacturing back to the United States, not only is that good for our economy, because you'll have good, high-paying, high production jobs, but you'll also be in our national security interest. And, I saw firsthand at my work at the State Department how China has been a bad faith actor, not just to other countries, but to their own people. And they do need to be held accountable for their role in spreading some of COVID-19 early on. And we also need to just be smart to not let them control our entire supply chain on core vital ingredients, especially in the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, and we could talk about this for a long, long time, and it would be really interesting. But I do have a bunch of questions from listeners for you, Mr. Mowers. So sure. I do want to go to them. And we got a listener email this morning about voting. This person says, President Trump has raised concerns about the reliability of mail-in voting. Just yesterday, Trump said he opposed additional funding for the U.S. Postal Service because of his opposition to mail-in voting. This person says there's been little evidence to show any issues with fraud with mail-in voting. Do you share his concerns? And I want to thank that person for writing.
Well, first of all, yeah, thank you so much for submitting the question. It's what makes NPR so great, are the listeners and the participation that everyone has. I think we're getting it right here in New Hampshire. What we did is allowed for those who do not feel comfortable going into the voting, the polling place because of COVID-19, to have an additional exemption for requesting an absentee ballot. And that's the way it should be. We believe in the ability for people to participate in the democratic process. We just also want to do it in a way that's controlled and ensures voter integrity, so that the votes of American citizens do count and we can ensure that they count towards the total. What you do have in some states, and this is where it really gets, sloppy, is that they have mailed out ballots to every single person on the list. Well, there's a percentage of turnover every single year in voter lists because people move are not along or around anymore because of natural causes. So we do need to ensure that that people are encouraged to vote. They should have the ability to vote by absentee the way we have here in New Hampshire. But it has to be done in a way that ensures voter integrity and control. And I'll tell you, I've seen it. It's funny. It seems controversial here, but even the Obama administration, I went on election monitoring processes in other countries, including in countries like Tunisia. And it was funded often by the same way that the Obama administration funded it. And they actually had checklists in place to ensure that there's voter integrity, including voter ID. So those are things that, America has asked other countries to do to protect their democratic processes. And I think that's, makes sense for us to do here at home as well. I think we get it right here in New Hampshire, though. I trust the government. I trust the governor. And I trust the Secretary of State on this.
Do you think, given the massive amount of absentee ballots that are expected to be cast this election, Mr. Mowers, that it's a good idea to cut funding at the Postal Service. Seems like they could be overwhelmed this year.
Well, I haven't seen any proposals to cut funding. So I've not seen that. And, you know, I haven't had a chance to even look through that all. You know, the post office has had some, funding shortfall challenges for a number of years. It's been improved at times when, you know, they're focused on, improved service delivery. You also now with the Postal Service, the gentleman running the Postal Service, the Postmaster General, has only been in the job now for a couple months. And from what I have seen, he is focused very much so ensuring that they have not just the resources, but really the model in place to ensure that they improve service delivery in the postal service and are prepared for an increase in absentee ballot voting in some states.
Another question that we've heard from a lot of listeners has to do with how state politicians are reacting to the protests we've seen around the country and in the state over police brutality, systemic racism in general. What's been your engagement with those diverse voices here in the Granite State out, you know, protesting and saying we want a better life for our kids and for our families? Have you been talking with those diverse voices, the people organizing the protests?
Well, Laura, look, you know, here in New Hampshire, we actually have in many ways a model for the rest of the country of how to engage with law enforcement. And, you know, I've met with a lot of leaders of law enforcement, whether it's the New Hampshire State Troopers, whether it's police chiefs throughout the district, whether it's rank and file patrolmen, who I've asked them these questions and I've run some of the national proposals by them. A lot of those are done here in New Hampshire already, whether it's community-based policing, which is very important, where, you know, law enforcement is working alongside the community and they don't feel like it's an antagonistic relationship, whether it's the fact that, you know, they haven't been taught how to use chokeholds in New Hampshire to law enforcement for nearly 30 years. Whether it's, you know, the fact that we don't have these turf wars that tend to develop in other states between local, state, and county law enforcement, because everyone goes through the same training academy here in New Hampshire. Those are all things that are good and should be used as a model to, and have a light shown on them. Unfortunately, Chris Pappas hasn't done that. You know, Chris Pappas voted for this bill that would have actually stripped away qualified immunity, which would, you know, there's, look, if a police officer commits a crime, they are held accountable for it. We see right now that, you know, the horrific incident we saw in Minneapolis, the police officer who committed that atrocity is being held accountable for it in a court of law the way he should. But what qualified immunity does is it ensures that the individual police officers and their families are not being able to be held personally liable through lawsuits, often frivolous lawsuits, from a lot of the same criminals that they're actually arresting. And so by stripping that away, what you're going to do, and I've talked to law enforcement about this, and they're willing to have an honest conversation, but it would lead to mass resignations of law enforcement officers across our country. Not only that, but they're already having trouble recruiting good people to serve in law enforcement. This will only make that recruitment harder. What we need right now is to have an honest conversation about what works and what doesn't. And it's a community-based approach. And unfortunately, right now, Chris Pappas has gone along with the political whims of his party down in Washington, D.C., and it's put our law enforcement at risk here in New Hampshire.
Well, and we could definitely dive into and probably will dive in on a later show on this issue of qualified immunity. There's some controversy around it. Justice Sonia Sotomayor on the left and Clarence Thomas on the right both have written about their concerns about qualified immunity. So there's a lot of differences of opinion on that one, but I'm going to set it aside for a moment. So you mentioned, you know, talking with police officers and about all these practices and policies. Have you been talking with Black Lives Matter organizers, the NAACP, some of the churches who were involved in this movement? What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, well, I'm hearing a lot of the same things, so especially from some folks in the NAACP. You know, I was actually at a dinner that they organized earlier this year and, big supporter of a lot of the efforts that they're trying to make. And look, they want to ensure that law enforcement is supported as well. Unfortunately, what you do have when you start getting into some of the other groups you mentioned is they are calling for defunding of the police. And while I'm always open to having a conversation with anyone about any topic, I am not going to support defunding the police. I think it's the wrong decision at the wrong time and will leave our communities at risk. You know, if we want to talk about how we can ensure that there are additional resources available, so we have mental health counselors that are on calls when needed to ensure that there are additional resources available for a more let's call it full of society approach, or full of when we're
systemic approach, bringing calls, in social services and so forth. Yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely, I'm all for that, but it's not going to come down to defunding the police. That's a dangerous idea, and anyone who says it's not a dangerous idea hasn't been looking at the crime stats, has not been looking at what we're asking our law enforcement professionals to do each day, and is not as playing politics instead of looking out for public safety. At the end of the day, I'm concerned about ensuring that our communities are safe. And I, you know, regardless of how you look, regardless of what socioeconomic class you are in, you have a right to feel safe in your community. And in order to do that, we have to have leaders stand with law enforcement, work with them, address issues as they arise. Absolutely. But like I said, here in New Hampshire, we're very fortunate that we have true professionals who are doing their jobs each day well, and that we need to be working with them, not against them. And unfortunately, too many politicians are using our police officers as a political punching bag instead of actually working with them to keep our community safe.
Well, Mr. Morris, and we discussed some of these big national issues, policing and the federal coronavirus response and so forth. I want to read an email that's a much more local concern. We received this before the show from a listener, Lily, who says, I live in Rockingham County, and our New Hampshire fishing industry has been hard hit by government overreach, Lily says. Burdensome restrictions limit their catch, how often they can fish, and what they can fish for. If elected, Lily wants to know, how would you remedy this situation? So go ahead, Mr. Mowers.
Yeah, it's a great question. I've met with a lot of commercial and individual fishermen and lobstermen because it affects both. And you do see, especially from NOAA regulations too often, that are made in some windowless conference room down at the Department of Commerce in Washington, D.C., they're often disconnected from the reality that our commercial fishermen rely on for their own livelihood. And look, obviously, we want to ensure that there's conservation of lobster and fish for future years. You know who's most interested in that? The commercial fishermen. Because otherwise, if they fish too much this year and there's not a catch for next year, it hurts their livelihood. But unfortunately, too many of these NOAA regulations actually make commercial fishermen, lobstermen put their lives at risk because it tells them the days they can go out, sometimes irrespective of what the weather conditions are. And what we should be doing, again, this is an example where we need to have the federal government bring all the stakeholders to the table to ensure that, yes, we're conserving for year after year, ensuring that we have lobster and fish for future years, but also that we're doing it that in a way that makes sense from the perspective of the commercial fishing industry. And, you know, the president just signed a few weeks ago an executive order that actually opened up a new section right off into the Atlantic Ocean for Maine and New Hampshire's fishermen to be able to catch. It was restricted really without justification several years ago, probably about 7 or 8 years ago now. And so the president has now signed an executive order that would open that up. I support that. It's in the best interest of our commercial fishing industry, which is so important to so many Granite Staters throughout, you know, in the industry.
Okay. Well, Lily, thank you for writing. Clearly a big issue and some news there. And Mr. Mowers, we have to wrap it up. We really appreciate you being with us today.
No, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, if folks want to learn more, they can go to mattmowers.com. Love to hear comments, and I try to respond to any email that I receive from folks who have follow-up questions.
Sure, and thanks everyone for writing in today. That was Matt Mowers, Republican running in the primary for the 1st Congressional District. Next week on The Roundup, our Meet the Candidate series continues with Lynn Blankenbecker. She's a Republican running in the 2nd Congressional District. Coming up, Governor Sununu's mask mandate for large gatherings and New Hampshire reaction to Kamala Harris's selection as the Democratic vice presidential nominee. As always, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We turn now to the state's top headlines, and helping us out for this week is Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Kevin, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Laura. Good to be with you.
So we'll be talking about the governor's new mask mandate for large gatherings. A little bit later, we'll gauge local reaction to Joe Biden's selection of Kamala Harris for vice president. And it's a chance right now, listeners, for you to get your thoughts in on these topics so we can include you in the conversation. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. So, Kevin, yesterday, Governor Sununu outlined the guidance for what will happen in that scenario that everybody's worried about of a coronavirus outbreak in schools. What was most important from this press briefing yesterday, Kevin?
Well, I think certainly what's most important is the protocol and the rules that will operate if a child tests positive for the virus, or a teacher for that matter. The state gives pretty detailed advice to parents and families of what they should do with that child, the kind of reporting that will occur once that child tests positive. The state will report it, of course, to the school. The school should communicate that to the community. And the other piece of it really was kind of walking through the weeds on what will happen, how big of an outbreak would have to occur to close a school building and return to remote learning for a certain period of time. There's talk about clusters and outbreaks. Now, a cluster is when at least three people in a classroom have the virus. An outbreak is when you have three clusters, three different sets of virus in the building, and you actually can prove there's been transmission from one cluster to another, whether it's in the cafeteria or outside in the playground. And it's once you have that outbreak, in many cases, the Department of Public Health will recommend to school administrators that you go to remote learning for at least 2 weeks.
Wow. Okay. So some clarity on what a cluster means and what an outbreak means. In that press conference, the governor also said the state will track positive cases in all school districts and publish the information on a centralized website so families can stay informed. I want to play a little bit, Kevin, from what the governor said about that. Let's hear.
If you get one positive case or some kids quarantining, rumors can go very quickly throughout the system. So we want to make sure that the data that has been confirmed and that we have is very available to the parents and the communities out there.
So, Kevin, what's the range of concerns about schools that the governor is trying to address? You mentioned he tried to address what a cluster is, what an outbreak is. He's also trying to address the transparency issue, how well people will be informed. What are some of the other issues that he's trying to, to make people feel a little bit better about?
Well, one of the things, one of the other developments that happened that's clearly related to this is he increased the capacity for childcare programs. He doubled the amount of kids that can be in a class in childcare from 10 to 20.
That's a big deal. Yeah.
It's critically important for parents. If kids are going to go back to school, in many cases, you need more capacity in daycare. And as we've seen during this, even throughout this pandemic, with a lot of daycares that have been open, there have been very few cases of COVID in daycare. So he has confidence that he can increase that capacity and really help folks out. This issue of any other since the beginning of the pandemic is the most difficult one for Chris Sununu. And the reason is local control. I mean, with every other issue in the pandemic, he's been in charge. He's been laying out what should and shouldn't happen in the community. With local control, he's deferring to every school district to make their own decisions. The state can only make recommendations. The state obviously has emergency powers, and if things really get out of hand, the state could conceivably close a school, even if the school didn't want to. But because he doesn't have that control, he's obviously gotten a lot of pushback, not only from political folks, but also from really concerned teachers and parents.
So what holes or unanswered questions did you hear about schools at the briefing, Kevin? For example, testing capacity. Yep. Did they talk about that? How do you track outbreaks or clusters if you don't have adequate testing?
Exactly. And I think that I think he acknowledged at the briefing that ideally we would have what Democratic legislative leaders called for earlier this week, which is rapid testing in all the public schools. Because at the end of the day, even if you have 3 to 4 days before you have a test result, you've got school administrators really blind about how pervasive the virus could be in their building.
Right.
So you could, in many, and that's what will be interesting to see in the absence of rapid testing, what school boards will do with this guidance, meaning will they be even more aggressive than this governor has been? Will they decide, for example, you know, if we have a number of different cases and we're still waiting for results on testing of all teachers and staff, we're going to go to remote learning for a week. And then within a week, we should have those test results. If we don't have rapid testing, and we'd have a better idea on whether we can bring everybody back or not.
Well, that's a lot of bouncing around, though, Kevin. It seems like without rapid testing, schools are going to be either clawing in the dark or kind of bouncing around, open, closed, until we get these results.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the frustrations, as I was saying, this governor has, as he's seen a number of school boards, Concord, Manchester, others decide, you know what, we're going to go mostly to remote learning.
It's just too difficult.
It's just too hard. It's too uncertain. And his view is some of these school boards aren't really even trying. And certainly politics gets into this. Obviously, you've got both teacher unions in the state of New Hampshire, the largest teacher unions, supporting the two Democratic primary candidates for governor. They pushed back a great deal on this governor's kind of flexibility in terms of school guidance. So he certainly questions whether a lot of these unions are trying to make his life more difficult, not less.
Wow. Well, and again, we did a whole program on this yesterday, how schools are making those choices. A lot of schools are going for a hybrid model. And as you just mentioned, Kevin, some of the bigger districts are saying without the rapid testing, it's too difficult. So Manchester, Concord, Pembroke, for example. And then some schools, especially in the North Country, are going all in, all day, regular old-fashioned instruction. So we covered that yesterday, how they're making their decisions. I also understand, Kevin, that the state announced yesterday relaxing of some restrictions around nursing homes. This will be really interesting news for a lot of people. So what are the details there?
Yeah, this is very important. Obviously, nursing homes has been the epicenter of the virus. 80% of deaths in New Hampshire have occurred in long-term care settings. The state worked many months to try and bring this virus under control in nursing homes. We're now down to only two nursing homes in the entire state where there remain outbreaks that aren't yet resolved. So Health and Human Services Commissioner Lori Chabanet felt this was the proper time to relax things. That the relaxing for all but those two nursing homes will be that for the first time, a visitor will be able to visit a resident inside the home. Another piece that's really important is non-essential workers in these nursing homes can now enter the building, including hairdressers. As Commissioner Chabanet has said, it sounds like a small thing, but it's so important to the self-esteem of residents to be able to get hair. And obviously they haven't been able to do that. In 2 weeks, there'll be further relaxing of restrictions in those counties where there's very low level of COVID. Right now, that would be Grafton, Coos, and Merrimack counties will be allowed to have two visitors inside for each resident. They will also be able to have communal dining as normal prior to the pandemic. Right now, dining is restricted in those nursing homes. And another important part is that residents would be able to take non-medical necessary trips outside the nursing home. So,
oh my goodness.
So conceivably that could be to visit a loved one. Again, if the risk was low, if everybody was tested prior for the virus. So folks are really looking forward to that next phase in a couple of weeks.
Okay, that's exciting news because my parents are both in assisted living facilities and, you know, it's been hard. It's been hard. So it'll be good for people to be able to visit more and do some activities and so forth. One more question on all this activities and announcement from the governor this week. He also required that people attending gatherings of more than 100 must wear masks. This has been a huge debate in New Hampshire, as you know, Kevin. What sparked this decision by the governor?
Well, certainly the images we saw from Sturgis, South Dakota, a quarter of a million bikers out in on the streets, not wearing masks, not practicing any social distancing. I think that was a wake-up call to this governor. We were surprised when he made the announcement. It came totally without warning. And as you point out, he's fought a mandatory mask mandate of any kind for months. But seeing that image, I think, concerned him. I think as well what concerned him, what is happening starting today in New Ipswich, where the Last Reformation evangelical group is meeting for the next 10 days. Up to 200 to 500 people will be there from not just New Hampshire, but from many states. They go door to door and spread the gospel. And the group has been clear that we're not going to abide by mask mandates. The town administrator in New Ipswich is pleading for this governor and Department of Public Health and the Attorney General's office to help with enforcement of this event. The town even sent out mailings to neighboring towns in Massachusetts to let them know this was going to occur. It's certainly, this is kind of a homegrown event that could easily get out of control. And just the type of super spreader event that this governor has been very concerned about. Folks talk about Bike Week, where that's going to occur in a couple of weeks. I think this governor felt even prior to Sturgis that the planning for Bike Week is well under control. There aren't going to be a lot of outdoor gatherings, the beer tents, the vendors on streets. Parking is going to be restricted at Bike Week. And there continue to be discussions between state and local officials about how to safely have such an important ceremony. It's rather some of these other events that really concerned him and prompted him to take this step. The devil's in the details, meaning he didn't want to disrupt things like wedding receptions, you know, with this mask mandate. So, for example, if you go to a wedding reception and you're assigned to a certain table with other people, you don't have to wear a mask at that table. You do
right.
have to.
You're a family group, so to speak. Yeah,
exactly. You do have to wear a mask when you're entering the building,
right.
And you have to wear it if you're moving from table to table.
And we did a whole program on that, and boy, it does get complicated. But it is interesting that the governor put this in place, given this religious revival that's coming, where attendees do not plan to be masked, and given some of the changes around Bike Week that have been made. It's going to be really different this year. Kevin, stand by for a few minutes, please, because I want to bring another voice into our conversation. With us now is former State Representative Jackie Weatherspoon, co-chair of the New Hampshire Democratic Party African American Caucus. And Jackie, it's great to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Laura. It is so good to be on the program and to see Kevin. And it's been a great program to listen to. Morning.
Well, I'm glad. And I wanted to fold you in because I wanted to ask you about vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris, presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden picking Harris this week. As most people know, she's a U.S. senator from California and a former state attorney general. What was your reaction to this, Jackie?
Well, I really wanted to go outside with a pot and just bang and make noise and celebrate. But instead, I sit in my living room and I clapped and I said, yes. Because, you know, Laura, I am always for women being at the table, expanding the table for so many years. You know, I was in Beijing, China in 1995. In fact, this is the 25th anniversary where 14 of us from New Hampshire went to Beijing, China. And part of that was about women as decision making. So this to me is the long walk for women being at the table. And as you know, in about 2 weeks, we're going to be celebrating the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote in the United States. So I'm just tickled, happy, excited, and now saying the work begins.
Well, were you surprised, Jackie, about this announcement?
I was an early endorser of her, not only because she was a woman, but because of her record. The United States, I think, Laura, is at a real crossroads. African-American women and women of color have had to fight, in a sense, for citizenship if voting is considered the rights of being a citizen. And we got the vote 100 years, I mean, so many years later, the 19th Amendment. So I didn't know if the country, to be honest with you, was ready for a woman of color initially. But I knew she had the credentials, she had the experience, and she is and will be ready to serve on day one. So I liked her, but I was teetering, like on a seesaw, if the United States was ready. And Joe Biden said he was, and I said yes. Because when I first endorsed her, even before our caucus, I said she's the right one. I called Ray and I called others and I said, I want to do this. And they said, okay, you can't represent the caucus at this point, but you can do it as an individual. And I did. And I'm very happy that I did because it speaks volumes for diverse women all around our country. It speaks volumes that we as decision makers come at life, experience, culture in different ways. And the United States, we can handle that. We've always, because the country of immigrants.
Since we're talking about Senator Harris, let's hear a little bit from her. Here she is speaking shortly after Joe Biden chose her as his vice presidential nominee.
After the most competitive primary in history, the country received a resounding message that Joe was the person to lead us forward. And Joe, I'm so proud to stand with you. And I do so mindful of all the heroic and ambitious women before me, whose sacrifice, determination, and resilience makes my presence here today even possible.
So again, that's Kamala Harris speaking shortly after presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden picked her to be his running mate. What concerns, Jackie, do you have, if any, as this ticket begins to campaign?
Well, you know, I think the opposition has already stated, you know, they're doing the birther, which is typical normal. They're saying that it's the left wing of the party, when we all know, when we look at her record, her being attorney general, what she has done around issues of mass incarceration, on so many of these issues, you know that she is not representing the far left. And she's served on our intelligence and judiciary committees. She understands exactly how the government should respond at home and around the world. So those are some of the criticisms that she's going to get. And I know from experience what happened with Hillary, the buzzwords will come out. But women are tired of that. Women of color are tired of that. And we're not going to let them keep the walk, us walking forward.
All right. Jackie, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's former State Representative Jackie Weatherspoon. She's co-chair of the New Hampshire Democratic Party African American Caucus. Real quick, back to you, Kevin Landrigan. Just remind us, how did Granite Staters view Senator Harris when she campaigned here for the New Hampshire presidential primary, which seems like a million thousand years ago at this point, back before the pandemic? But just remind us how that went down, Kevin.
Yeah, certainly wasn't a great experience for her running in New Hampshire, but Joe Biden had the same experience. Joe Biden has never finished better than fifth in a New Hampshire presidential primary, including this one, where he left, if you recall, before the returns were in. Kamala Harris entered this race with a lot of promise and had a lot of energy in New Hampshire when she got here. But the view from many, not just activists, but on the ground, people could observe, she really wanted to break through in South Carolina after New Hampshire. And so she did not spend as much time here as virtually all the other major candidates. For example, I mean, she gave a speech, a really good speech at the convention in September of 2019 and didn't return before she dropped out of the race in December. But as I say, that those kind of experiences don't necessarily tell you what kind of vice presidential candidate you're going to have. There have been many, Al Gore, John Edwards. There have been many candidates who didn't do well here in New Hampshire, didn't win in New Hampshire during the first primary, but were more than serviceable running mates. And I think she will be just that. She's very articulate. She's very outspoken. She's a good debater, as Joe Biden knows, unfortunately, to his demise at one debate.
Yeah, we all remember that moment. Sure.
So, and I think he's made this choice in this, really, it's almost like a reverse mirror if you think of what Barack Obama did in 2008. A first-term senator, African-American, questions about his experience. He turns to a veteran, white, senior senator, very popular with moderate Republicans, someone who could work across the aisle, and it gave great balance to that ticket. Here, obviously, 12 years later, Joe Biden is a senior statesman, right, who's been a vice president for 8 years. What does he really need? He needs youth. He needs vitality. He needs someone who does appeal to the more progressive wing of the party. And he's chosen Kamala Harris to do that. And I think she will pretty effectively.
Kevin, before we let you go, I do need to say congratulations. You were honored just recently by the New Hampshire Press Association with a Lifetime Achievement Award, an honor well-deserved, I think, Kevin, given your many decades covering New Hampshire politics. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thanks so much, Laura. I call it the Older Than Dirt Award, which But it's always nice to be recognized. And I've really been really struck during this pandemic how, in the face of real great odds that journalists face in New Hampshire, how much great work has been done across the state. And I'm seeing what's really one of the bright lights of this pandemic is I'm seeing the public recognize that as well. Many wow. more positive comments, emails, texts from readers, viewers, listeners, when they hear important news about their community.
Well, Kevin, it's great to talk to you, and congratulations again.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Kevin Landrigan, State House Bureau Chief with the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, longtime reporter here in the Granite State. Coming up, the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup continues with the news from the North Country. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We go to the North Country now to hear how that region has fared with COVID-19 and the summer tourism season. With us now is Charlie Jordan, longtime North Country journalist and editor of the Colebrook Chronicle. Charlie, welcome back to The Exchange. I wish we were in my studio together, but here we are remotely. It's really nice to talk to you again.
It's great to hear you, Laura. It's a great, great program you have here.
So before we turn to the school year, there are still a few weeks left of a glorious New Hampshire summer. I'm biased. This is my favorite time of the year. How has the summer tourism season been so far in your region, Charlie? Who was coming in? What were they coming for?
I've been really surprised, Laura, that the tourism in the area seems to be at the level it's at. It's, I guess we all expected it to become kind of like a ghost town up here, you know, and but the ATV phenomenon, which has been going on for quite a few years now, doesn't seem to have abated at all. I mean, as a matter of fact, I'm wondering if this summer what we're seeing is a result of people having been sort of kind of cooped up so long that they're all pointing their vehicles north here. So a lot of activity out on the trails. Of course, that's the kind of recreation that's kind of pandemic made, I guess, even though we don't have a lot of the events we normally have. So we're seeing a lot of people on weekends, particularly with the trailers coming north.
Well, yeah, you've got the kind of activities that people are encouraged to do, you know, mountain biking, hiking, camping, people getting together in family groups, you know, on their ATVs. So in a way, not that bad, Charlie?
I hate to say that there's any silver linings in this terrible thing we're going through, but it does seem like people are rediscovering their own world around them. And here, you know, in northern New Hampshire, we're all about the outdoors. So you see families doing weekend hikes out into the wilds, you know, where they may have said, well, stay home, or, you know, it's giving them a chance to really get out. And, you know, it is one of the few benefits, I would say, that we're experiencing right now.
There are, you touched on this, Charlie, some great summer traditions in your area, the Colebrook Moose Festival, the Lancaster Fair. What's happening with those, Charlie?
Well, it's the slate has been cleared. I mean, it's like, I think many events were waiting, you know, to see what the Lancaster Fair decided. And when the Lancaster Fair decided a month or so ago to cancel, then it was like a house of cards. All the other events started to, you know, fall apart too. Some of the events, you know, what people don't, I think, fully understand is how much months of planning go into an event like the Lancaster Fair or the Moose Festival.
Sure,
I mean,
years of
got
planning.
Vendors and, you know, and exhibitors and whatever that have to be, you know, set up a long time in advance. So when that looked like things were not going to really change, people started canceling. So the traditional, some of the smaller events, oh, Laura, have been going on. Like last Friday, we had the Sugar on Snow social in the area here. And the people who were dishing out the maple syrup all had face shields on. It was a church group there. And it was in a park, and people were pretty well socially distanced. So the smaller events are doing the best they can, but the grand events just aren't there this year.
You're involved in the local arts community, Charlie, you and your paper. How have you guys adapted? It's been a tough time for arts organizations all over the state.
Yeah, it has been. I mean, we acquired about 3 years ago the former Our Lady of Grace Shrine in Columbia, which is right on the town line of with Colebrook. And there's like 10 acres of open ground. So we're one of the few at the Great Northwoods Center for the Arts that has this opportunity to do things outdoors. Right. So on Monday, we had the Weather Vane Theater's youth group, Patrick Players, and they put on a Disney show right in the middle of the field, and people were distanced all around, and we had people of all ages. We attracted probably about 50 people. This follows up on something I saw last weekend, which I thought was kind of really neat. The North Country Chamber of Commerce has reintroduced the concept of drive-in movies. You remember those?
Yes, I do. They had one in Keene. Well,
they're coming back, because of this. So they took a local ball field and they got a sort of an inflatable screen, and they showed the film Grease, when was that? In the 70s, I guess. And so people showed up with their convertibles and their old hot rods and whatever, and filled the field, and the drive-in theater was back, for a night.
We'll just hope for good weather in the fall so some of this can continue.
Well, once the weather changes, I think a lot of these events are going to have to rethink how we're doing some things. But
well, we're going day by day. So what about schools, Charlie? What's the plan in your region?
I think Kevin really touched on that in your segment just before this. The schools are the one area that the state really has left to each district. And boy, are we seeing it up here. I mean, we have four school districts, three of them in New Hampshire and one in Vermont that we cover. And each one of these have been grappling with how far shall we go? What direction should we turn to? On a personal level, I've talked to everybody from bus drivers to art teachers to they're just saying, I just can't go back in. And they're really making career changes on the fly here, whether they feel safe or not to go back into the schools. I will say that the schools are taking every step possible, I think, especially with these hybrid programs, to try to make people feel safe. But, we just don't know until we get in there and what's going to happen, So keeping up with all of these school districts, our front page, we're covering, last week it was SAU 7, which covers the Colebrook area. This week we have three more districts and what they're doing, and every one of them is different from the next.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and trying to keep that within the context of a newspaper that doesn't look like a phone book, because they all have details, that are just right on down to the fine-tooth information here. So
that's interesting. And correct me if I'm wrong, Charlie, I had thought that more schools in the North Country would be doing all in-person instruction because of the low level of cases in your area. I heard that Bartlett was going all in-person, North Conway.
They primarily
are. Gorham was, yeah.
They primarily are, but for example, I think it's SAU 36, which covered the Lancaster area, they're advising people, if you're not going to send your kids to school, you should be considering a charter school. Well, the charter school, student bodies are all filled right now. So where do you go if you're a parent? Each one of these has sort of a backup plan. But certainly the main thrust is to open the doors and see where we go from there,
What other stories is your paper tracking, Charlie, in addition to the tourism impact of the pandemic and the schools? What else are you guys looking at?
Well, I find one thing interesting is how this COVID-19 has impacted everything. I mean, this week, for example, on our front page, we have two interviews, one with a woman who's running right across the border here in Vermont for a state rep. And then we also, that's Martha Allen. We also speak with Lynn Blankenbecker for her run. Now, the topics suddenly are turning to the impact of the pandemic. Martha, for example, we spoke with quite a bit about how the North Country has been really having some difficulty with the remote learning because of the lack of, the technology there that are much more available elsewhere. So that change needs to come. And Blankenbecker was talking about her own personal experience, which I thought was fascinating. I mean, she got COVID-19. I mean, she went back off the campaign trail and went on to that ship that they brought into New York, the Comfort, and she was a nurse there because that's what her career is a military nurse. And to talk, it was funny, halfway through the interview, of course, we were masked, then she revealed that she had COVID, and you almost had to like back out of the room. But then she said, you know, that was in April, and
yeah, it was a long time ago,
and everything. But to talk with these people and how it's impacting, it's amazing, you know. So it changes the stories and takes it into some new areas.
So in covering the election, which everything with that's going on, and sometimes it's easy to forget that there is an election coming up, the state's primary elections. Just a couple weeks away. And actually next Friday, I'm glad you mentioned Lynn Blankenbecker, because she will be the guest on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup for the first 20 minutes or so of the show. Charlie Jordan, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you for being with us, Charlie. Take care. That's Charlie Jordan. Longtime North Country journalist and editor of the Colebrook Chronicle. And again, The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our fellow is Jane Vaughn. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. I'm Laura Kanoy.